Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the UCF College of Business, offering the new online space MBA, designed for professionals in innovative and high-growth industries. Beginning spring 2026, students gain advanced business skills through the lens of the space economy. Learn more at business.ucf.edu/space MBA.
Starship Success and Neptune's Peculiar Tag-Along. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. On its 10th test flight, SpaceX's Starship successfully launched from Boca Chica, Texas, and just a little over an hour later, it made a splash landing in the Indian Ocean.
There's a splashdown.
It's a big step in SpaceX's ambitious Starship program, which is also playing a part in NASA's plans to land humans on the moon. We'll speak with Main Engine Cutoff's Anthony Colangelo about the flight and what SpaceX needs to accomplish moving forward. Then, a new discovery shows a distant object in a weird pattern with Neptune, and its discovery could help scientists understand more about our solar system, specifically these icy outer planets. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? SpaceX's Starship program is hoping to land humans on the moon and eventually Mars. But to do that, the company needs to prove it can fly. Last week, it did just that. On its 10th test flight, Starship launched from Boca Chica, Texas, and landed successfully in the Indian Ocean about an hour later. It's a big step in an ambitious program, but SpaceX still has a ways to go. Here to talk more about the test flight and the path ahead is Anthony Colangelo. He's the host of the podcast Main Engine Cutoff and co-host of the podcast Off Nominal. Anthony, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
It's always good to be here.
Starship made its 10th flight and the first of a successful flights. Tell us a bit about what happened during launch and why SpaceX engineers are calling this a success.
You know, it's been a rough year for Starship. We've had three failed launches and then a ship exploded on a test stand, which I think we talked about the last time I was here. It's been a year of kind of lost time, honestly. The roadmap for Starship hasn't really progressed in a year. They've had a variety of different problems, and there was a lot of, you know, worry about how things actually were going to go here. So to get this one under their belt and actually do it successfully from what we could see from the outside and even some of the updates that we've had since launch, they hit all of their objectives, all of their milestones for the launch. They deployed some Starlink simulators, which has been a thing that they haven't gotten to yet, was actually deploying payloads out of this giant launch vehicle. And that's critical both for Starship itself, but Starlink as well needs bigger satellites that can't fit on a Falcon 9 to kind of get to the next level for bandwidth and the service they're trying to provide. So huge moment for both programs there. And then they actually got through reentry this time, testing out a couple of different things, new heat shield tiling, a couple of areas that they tested, different kinds of tiles or different sort of setups. They also have moved the fins since the last time that they did a successful reentry. So they were able to test the new control systems out for that. And unless they have a fleet of buoys out in the ocean somewhere, it looks like they nailed, you know, they said they were in 3 meters of where they were hoping to be for the reentry and splashdown. We got awesome videos, drone videos of this thing coming back in and splashing down in the ocean. So it was just finally, we got to this point where they were successful with these things. They can now move on to what's left on their roadmap for Starship.
And what is left on that roadmap?
There's a big milestone coming up soon. So they're moving on to the V3 version of the ship and importantly, Raptor engine. But they have one more V2, as they call it, one more V2 ship left to go. So what they're going to do on that next flight, if they still go ahead and fly that piece of hardware, is a little bit unknown. If they're going to fly a very similar flight as this to test out some of those the heat shield tweaks that they applied there. If you watch that drone video I just mentioned, the ship looks pretty crazy coming back in. It's got all these wild orange streaks on it. It's got some weird white areas of like debris of some sort. And there was worry at first, like, did something go wrong? But the update we got out of Elon Musk was that it was oxidation from metallic tiles that they had on board, which made the orange. And then the other area was where they've removed heat shield and the insulation was kind of strewn along the nose of the ship. So are they going to test some different configurations of those things out? Are they just going to fly it again to continue to prove out how Raptors can fire in space so that when they then get onto the first of the V3 vehicles, everyone thinks early next year, 2026, they actually can go ahead and that will be the one that goes to orbit. So 2026 is the year of the milestones where we thought 2025 would be. So what we're looking ahead for is actually going to full orbit. They haven't been to officially, you know, orbital yet with Starship. They've been all suborbital flights. Once they're able to do that reliably, they can launch two Starships very quick back to back and do the most important test of the Starship roadmap, which is in-space propellant transfer so that they can launch a Starship, launch another one, refill the fuel in the first one, and do these more complex missions that they have planned, like going to land on the moon or deploying really heavy payloads or going to Mars eventually.
You know, we mentioned this is the 10th flight, first one successful. Many of them have exploded spectacularly or you know, broken apart during reentry. But this is part of SpaceX's engineering philosophy, right? Break it and learn from it. You know, an outsider might look at this and say that, you know, these nine flights beforehand were failures, but this is really SpaceX's philosophy and how it designs and engineers, right?
Absolutely is. I think the biggest difference has just been some of the ways that they've failed and the fact that they failed in the same way twice in a row we haven't seen from SpaceX before. They have been a company that fails a lot in public but fixes a lot in public, and they got stuck in a way that we hadn't seen them get stuck before. So when you couple that with the fact that there has been, you know, hiring and retention issues down in the Starbase area, it's really hard to get people to move all the way down to the southern tip of Texas when they have families that live elsewhere or want different lifestyles or don't care for the environment down there, or don't want to live in a swamp or in an airstream or something, right? And we've heard this not just unique to SpaceX, but Rocket Lab has this new rocket they're working on out at Wallops Island, Neutron. It's hard to get people to work out on the eastern shore of Virginia and the kind of weird Delmarva Peninsula that even people in my area don't go to all that often. So there's this fundamental tension between rockets are things that you launch from very remote sites, and people don't often want to work at very remote sites. So we've heard a lot of issues of hiring and retaining people down there. And we heard that at the same time, they got stuck on these kind of technical issues and these failures. And it just felt like, you know, is this a different era of SpaceX, or are they going to be able to get through it? Now we know they're getting through that, and hopefully we don't hit the same kind of rough patch when we get to V3.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? Here on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Anthony Colangelo. He's the host of the podcast Main Engine Cutoff and co-host of the podcast Off Nominal. Kind of regulatory reviews are underway for SpaceX's Starship facility in my neck of the woods down here at the Kennedy Space Center. Do we know if that would be used for any of the testing, and does that help with retention if they move operations to Kennedy?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's there's an aspect to it in that even now with Starship, we saw some reports from Lauren Grush at Bloomberg a week or two back that during this terrible year that Starship's had, they moved up to 20% of the Falcon 9 staff over to Starship to actually help out and work through some of the testing issues that they had and component level testing that they could do. So reassigning people from an old program to a new program is what companies tend to do. And the idea is that you transition off of Falcon onto Starship as Starship becomes mature. And to do that, you need more facilities. You know, you see how many launch pads Falcon 9 has. We're going to need some new ones for Starship, especially when, you know, a single shot to the moon is going to take 15 refuelings or whatever. We've got to have as many Starship pads as we can possibly get to go and launch as many Starships as we need. So the thought now is that, you know, Starbase is going to be this kind of development and test center for Starship, but that places like Cape Canaveral, Kennedy Space Center would be operational level Starship. Certainly, you know, the pads that are out there are substantial compared to what they have to build up on their own out in Texas. You've got, you know, launch pads that were built for a rocket even bigger than Saturn V, and here comes one along in the history of spaceflight that is bigger than Saturn V. Let's put it out at the launch site where it needs to be. They've also got, what is it, Slick 37B, where the Delta IV Heavy used to launch from. So another very large launch site that makes sense for Starship. And then you also have this idea of flying the boosters back to the launch towers and flying the ships back to the launch towers. I think this might be one of the understated aspects of moving to Florida, is that to land a ship back on a tower, to catch a ship in a tower, you have to fly over a lot of land if you do it in the south tip of Texas. And you've got to fly over a lot of land that isn't the country that you're launching from, which becomes very, you know, legally complex, especially with a vehicle that hasn't really done that before. So turns out if you go to Florida, it's just your house that we have to fly over rather than, you know, a lot of Mexican territory that we'd have to coordinate with a different government. So I think, you know, you might give it a thumbs up more than, you know, multiple international governments would do.
So you mentioned, you know, there needs to be a lot of these Starship flights for these Artemis missions. And one of the key aspects of those flights is refueling and moving cryogenic fuel in space, which, as you outlined earlier in our conversation, that is something that has not been demonstrated yet, but needs to be. Where is SpaceX with that? And can you just explain why this is so critical to the plan to get Starship to the moon and beyond.
Yeah. So the idea is kind of just from a raw perspective of logistics, right? You've got a lot of fuel that you need to launch everything from the ground into orbit. And then you've got a bunch of payload in orbit with no fuel left. And so an idea is to go up and launch more fuel, refill that ship, and send it off to wherever it needs to go, especially when where it needs to go is down all the way to the lunar surface and then back up to Orion waiting in lunar orbit. So this infrastructure really changes the way that you organize these missions. Whereas before, you'd have to launch from the ground all the propellant that you need to get where you're going and back, right? You think about the Saturn V in the Apollo days, it had to launch all of the fuel that it needed to launch all of the fuel that it needed. It's a really bizarre, you know, the rocket equation is what it's called. It's when you add more fuel, you got to add more fuel, and it kind of runs away from you pretty quick. But they had to launch the whole stack. They had the lander, they had the capsule that brings the crew home, and they had everything they needed on board that one launch. This is distributing that out to many launches. But what you need to do is keep those propellant tanks stocked up with enough propellant to make it where you need to go. And by doing that, you actually increase the amount that you can take to any given location, because you can take a whole bunch of payload up to orbit and then stage more propellant from there and take that entire chunk of payload to somewhere else in the solar system. So it's a different way of working than we've done in the past. It's more complex because it involves a lot of rendezvous and proximity operations. And the other aspect is you got to transfer this propellant without gravity. So one of the interesting parts of these tests is going to be when they actually dock two starships together, they're going to spin these up in a way that creates a little bit of artificial gravity, which helps propellant flowing, because if you've ever watched videos of the space station, when they kind of drip a little water out, it just forms a ball and it floats in space because there's just no gravity pulling in any direction. So spinning up these starships is actually going to create artificial gravity, which will help slide the propellant into the other ship. So it'll be a very interesting test to watch. We've done small scale propellant transfers in space before. The ISS itself gets reloaded with the propellant, but not cryogenic in the way that you're talking about, which is super cold propellants that need to be kept super cold in order to fit in the fuel tanks and have the performance that they need. So probably the coolest thing that we'll see in the next 5 years of spaceflight, and one of the most important things that we'll see in this era for sure.
Anthony, a lot needs to happen for those Artemis moon missions. Eventually, Elon wants to get Starship to Mars. Where are we looking timeline-wise?
It's interesting, right? You roll the clock back a year or two, and the politics of this were in a weirder spot where Elon Musk had a lot of sway in the administration. That has come and gone. There was thoughts in the early days that, you know, maybe the moon would kind of go out of vogue again and Mars would come back into the sights. That has sort of gone away as well. Artemis remains front and center, especially from the congressional side. And there's a lot to be done for those Artemis missions themselves that will keep SpaceX busy. So Elon Musk is a little bit mercurial when it comes to these kind of tasks, but the rest of the SpaceX crew is very focused on what needs to be done. Especially Gwynne Shotwell is very focused on serving the customers that they've signed up, especially for contracts as big as this. So I do think that's going to take most of the interest. What's interesting is that the more they solve problems for Starship here on Earth, it makes Mars a lot easier as well, because you need a really good heat shield for Earth. You need a pretty good heat shield for Mars. It's not as much atmosphere. So if you make a really good one for Earth, the Mars part becomes a lot easier. So as they get better with coming back through an atmosphere and landing on a pinpoint, you know, getting caught by a tower, that really plays into what they're doing at Mars anyway. So it's not like they're burning time working what they need to for Mars by working on the moon. But I still think, you know, we're a couple of launch cycles away from, you know, they haven't even been to orbit yet with this ship. They haven't been to orbit. They haven't caught the ship. They haven't really figured out the reusable heat shield in the way that they need to in its final form. I think they're going to really focus on getting through those things first. And I say that, but also I'm like, man, just send one of these things to Mars. You got like 18 starships down there in Texas. Just fling one off there once you've got, you know, enough propellant to do so. Maybe they will do that to test out some, you know, deep space communication systems and whatnot. But it still feels like we're, I don't know. I hate time predictions, but it's like 5 years off still before I'm worried about it.
Mm-hmm. So plenty of time for you to come back on the show and let us know what's going
plenty
on when
time.
It comes to Starship. So.
Yeah, man. I mean, I'll come down and hang out for the Starship launches in Florida. So it'll be
sounds
it'll
good.
Be great.
Looking forward to it. Anthony Colangelo is the host of the podcast Main Engine Cutoff. Check it out for news about Starship and everything else happening in commercial space. Anthony, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Brennan.
Still to come, strange objects at the edge of our solar system.
This object is really far from Earth. So Earth is about one astronomical unit from the sun. Neptune is at about 30 astronomical units from the sun. Right now, the object is at around 40 astronomical units, so it's a little farther than Neptune. But what's really cool about it is that it has a very non-circular orbit.
That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the UCF College of Business, offering the new online space MBA, designed for professionals in innovative and high-growth industries. Beginning spring 2026, students gain advanced business skills through the lens of the space economy. Learn more at business.ucf.edu/space MBA.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. Alongside Neptune and far out in our solar system, things like trans-Neptunian objects, or TNOs, also orbit our sun. Pluto falls into this category. But one TNO is puzzling scientists because of its peculiar relationship with Neptune. Our producer Marion Summerall spoke with Rosemary Pike, an astronomer at the Minor Planet Center, which is hosted at the Center for Astrophysics, Harvard and Smithsonian, about this TNO and what's next for studying faraway objects just like it. Here's that conversation now.
Rosemary, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here to talk about this unique object. Rosemary, this object is part of what's called a trans-Neptunian object, also known as an object that's just really far away. Let's just talk about where it is in comparison to Earth.
This object is really far from Earth. So Earth is about 1 astronomical unit from the sun. Neptune is at about 30 astronomical units from the sun. Right now, the object is at around 40 astronomical units, so it's a little farther than Neptune. But what's really cool about it is that it has a very non-circular orbit, and we found it at kind of its closest approach. So its average distance from the sun is about 140 astronomical units. So 140 times the distance from the Earth to the sun.
Okay, yeah, that's pretty far. And walk me through its discovery and kind of why it piqued interest within the science community. How was it found?
Yeah, so we found it with a survey we ran on the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope. And we were looking specifically for these distant trans-Neptunian objects. What we do is we take a series of images and we're looking at one image and then an image, say, about an hour later and an image an hour after that. And we're looking for little dots of light that move between those frames. And so when you first find something, you're looking for a small amount of movement over a couple of hours. And then over time, we look for it again and again, and we can sort of predict a little farther out each time we find it, how much farther it's going to be the next time we look for it.
Okay, kind of like putting a puzzle together.
Yeah, so if you've seen, say, the pictures of like 3i, when they first found it, it's just this little dot. And we find it in one night. We try to find it again about a week later. We try to find it about a month later. And you try to find it a couple of times within a year. And at that point, you know really accurately how far away it is, but you can't actually say what its average distance from the sun, semi-major axis, is to very high accuracy, because we're looking at 5 months worth of object motion for an object that has an orbital period around the sun of about 1,600 years. So it's a very, very small fraction. So we need to get a couple of years before we can really say to high accuracy what the orbit actually is. So this object goes around the sun once. Every time Neptune goes around the sun, exactly 10 times. And the periodicity of that makes the object's orbit more stable. And so we see lots of objects in resonances with Neptune, the most well-known one being Pluto. Pluto is in a 3-2 resonance with Neptune. So every time Neptune goes around 3 times, Pluto goes around the sun twice. And it's basically protected from close encounters with Neptune, because anytime it gets closest to the sun, Neptune is far away. So this object is in the 10-1 resonance, and we have a conclusive classification. It's definitely resonant. So it's the largest semi-major axis securely classified resonant object that we know of. It's not entirely unexpected that we'd have some of these distant objects in these really distant resonances, but this is the farthest one that we found to date.
And even though it's so far, it's kind of in almost a dance with Neptune. What is this dance? Is it in orbit with the planet? And like you said, you know, this isn't necessarily unexpected, but have you seen anything else like this before?
Yeah, so we have found other objects in other, what we would say, N-to-1 resonances. So the 5-1 resonance and the 7-1 resonance. We've seen other objects in similar resonances. And it is really interesting that even though it's so much farther from the sun than Neptune, Neptune is still has a very dramatic impact on its orbit. So every time it comes in close to the sun, it has a constrained orbital location with respect to Neptune. This object is also very tilted with respect to the ecliptic plane. So if you think of the plane of the solar system that the Earth and the sun are in, all the planets are pretty close to that sort of flat plane. And then the Kuiper Belt in general is a little bit puffier, but nothing like this object, which is tilted 33 degrees out of the Earth-Sun plane. And so that actually also produces some really different interactions with Neptune over time than we've seen before.
So if we were kind of looking at it almost like a picture, I'm trying to wrap my head around it, it would almost be like below Neptune if you were kind of looking at it like that?
Yeah, it comes to its closest approach either below or above Neptune. So if you were looking at the solar system edge on, it would either be below or above it. It does a big loop that goes up and through.
You know, new technology, new telescopes, and even there's that giant new observatory we've covered on Are We There Yet? The Vera C. Rubin Observatory. It's coming online soon. It's got these capabilities. And specifically, this observatory is going to be able to scan the sky like never before for some of these things. Could we find more that are in this kind of weird tilt? What about with other planets?
Yeah, so we're really excited about Vera Rubin Observatory and the survey they're running there. So we should find a lot of very tilted objects. Historically, a lot of surveys looking for transneptunian objects have focused on the plane, that the Earth-Sun plane, because that's where you find the most, because there are a lot of objects there. And you can find objects that have a large tilt if you look there, because they always pass through the plane at some point, but you're preferentially finding these objects that are in the ecliptic. So there's an ecliptic component of the Vera Rubin survey plan. And that will find a lot of transneptunian objects. But I am definitely particularly excited for the fact that it's going to be an all-sky survey, and it's going to find a lot of these moving objects that are at large inclinations as well. In the outer solar system, Neptune is pretty dominant in terms of interacting with these planetesimals. There are some effects that we see of Uranus, and then there are some sort of combined effects of the total evolution of all the planets that we see in the outer solar system, but it's predominantly Neptune. Jupiter does have a lot of resonant sculpting in the asteroid belt, where it's much closer and more dominant. But in our solar system, in the outer reaches, we're talking predominantly about Neptune.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Marion Summerall. I'm speaking with Rosemary Pike, an astronomer at the Minor Planet Center, which is hosted at the Center for Astrophysics, Harvard, and the Smithsonian. These kinds of objects right there, we know that they're kind of old and that they could potentially answer a lot of questions about our universe, about our planets and things like that. And our solar system specifically, if we were able to find more objects like this one and we're able to study this object more, what kind of questions could this answer about our solar system?
Yeah, so there are a couple of different things that we like to do once we find things. We can figure out, say, how many objects we expect to have a similar orbital configuration. And when we can say, for example, we found a lot more of these and there were more than we expected, that would imply that sometime in the past, there was some giant planet scattering that preferentially scattered stuff that preferentially populated this region of space. If alternatively we find way less things than we expect, then there must have been some sort of clearing event that happened at some point in the past. So where these objects are found and how many objects there are give us clues about how the outer solar system and the giant planets formed and then evolved over time.
Are these almost like time capsules of like the creation of our solar system?
Yeah. So they record the history of the solar system. You can see the sculpting in the outer solar system based on the planets. Another thing that we do to understand more about that process is we can look at their composition or their surface reflectivity. So are they predominantly red or blue, and what might that mean for where they formed? So we try to look at their orbits and where they are and what they're made of. And in particular, it's very exciting to see the JWST data that's coming out now, because for a very long time, these objects have all been too faint for us to look at them spectroscopically and actually understand what ice they're made of. So these are like the distant cold remnants.
And Rosemary, specifically for you, what excites you the most about this new discovery?
Yeah, I guess I've been interested in the distant solar system for a long time. I really like basically the way that it records the long-term history of the solar system. It's like a fossilized record of what has happened in the history of the solar system. For this object, it's been particularly interesting because the type of orbital resonance that it has is something that we haven't really seen before in the solar system. So usually the objects always come to their closest approach far away from the planet that they're resonant with. And because of the inclination that this object has, that the large tilt, it can actually come in to closest approach aligned with Neptune, which is very unusual. Kind of will affect the way that we plan surveys in the future, because typically we say if we're looking to find stuff in a resonance, we don't look near where Neptune is. We always want to try to find them at barycenter where they're brightest. And that's because they all are shown in reflected sunlight. So the sunlight has to travel all the way out to the object and then all the way back to the Earth. So we're never going to find it at its apocenter, its farthest distance, or even probably at its like average distance. We're always going to find these when they're closest to their closest approach in this size range. So if we're looking for things that we try to discover when they're at closest approach, we need to really understand where their closest approach is. And that's going to be really exciting to see how that fills in with the Vera Rubin discoveries as well.
What's next? What questions still remain unanswered? And what's next for kind of learning more about this object overall?
For this object in particular, we need to do a little bit of theoretical investigation to better understand this particular very weird resonance. And we also are going to expand that analysis to include some other objects we found in the same survey, which is the Large Inclination Distant Object Survey. We also found an object in the 7-to-1 resonance, and we found an object in the 5-to-1 resonance. And they all show similar weird behavior. So we want to follow up with all of those and better understand those. We also have a bunch of other interesting discoveries in the same survey as well, which this survey was a large inclination survey. So we were looking for these very tilted objects specifically and getting a handle on the range of different things that we find in this survey that is off ecliptic will be really key for being ready to understand the discoveries from the Vera Rubin telescope.
I'm fascinated and I'm really excited to see kind of what we find with these objects and hopefully answering age-old questions and kind of looking at these giant preserved fossils of our solar system. Rosemary Pike is an astronomer at the Minor Planet Center, which is hosted at the Center for Astrophysics, Harvard, and the Smithsonian. Rosemary, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the Central Florida Public Media app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, YouTube, or really wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show. Follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. Our handle is at @AWTYSpace. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out to us. We're at arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.